So we're going to discuss proteins as our third class of macromolecules. They are arguably the most interesting and the most important macromolecules in the cell. I hope you'll can form an opinion on that in a few weeks. Because proteins is going to take us deep into the workings of the cell when we discuss their function. But first, we're going to discuss their structure, as always. And we're going to start by talking about the monomers and the structure and properties of the monomers. So the monomers for the proteins are the amino acids. And I brought them in briefly before. All the amino acids have this basic structure, a central carbon to which is attached an amino and an acid group, the carboxylic acid group, thus amino acid, usually a hydrogen, and usually a side group, which varies into 20 different varieties. Let's take a look a little more accurately in aqueous solution at pH 7, then, because the amine is a strong enough base to gain a proton at pH 7, and the carboxyl strong enough to lose that proton. They're going to have a, both of these groups are going to be charged. With a full charge and of opposite nature. So unless there's some charge on the R group, which usually there isn't, but sometimes there is, if there isn't, then the net charge in this molecule would be zero because it's plus one and minus one. But it's charged nonetheless. It has two full charges. It's going to attract water molecules like crazy. And so it's very polar. This part of the molecule is very polar. And although it has no charge, like unlike a sodium ion or a chloride ion, which always has a charge when it's an ion, this is an ion that has no net charge. It's given a special name, Zwitter ion. If you see that in your books, then this is what it means. I don't believe we'll use that term again, just in case you see it. Now let's talk about these charges, and let's talk about acidity and basicity in a little more detail. When I say it's charged, I mean there is an equilibrium between the charged and uncharged state for an amine or a carboxylic acid, always. And this big arrow here indicates, for instance, that at pH 7, if you consider the carboxyl group, there is a little bit that's protonated, but at pH 7, the vast majority, 99.99%, and we can take a little bit of a look at that number in a minute, is in the uncharged state, so it has a big arrow going to the left here in graphic 3. I think it's really graphic 2. Anyway, graphic number 3, to the charged state, and a little arrow going in this direction. And equilibrium means these molecules are changing one form to the other all the time. Now, pH 7 is, I keep saying, is the usual case for a cellular environment, for a biological environment, but it's not certainly completely true, even in biological systems. There are organelles, for example, in our skin cells and other cells called lysosomes, in which the pH is around 4.5 or even 4, and sort of inside our bodies, or not inside our cells, in our stomachs, pH 2. So we consider reactions going on even at pH 2 inside mammals. Furthermore, as we manipulate these molecules in the laboratory, we can make the pH whatever we want. We can add hydrochloric acid and make it pH 1, pH 0.1, or pH 12 with sodium hydroxide. So we should consider what's happening to these any organic chemical, but the amino acids in particular now, when we change the pH. So if we start out with our exemplary amino acid here at pH 7, where I just said has a net charge of zero, if there's no charge in the R group. And now we go and put it in a test tube and add sodium hydroxide. That will drop the concentration of free hydrogen ions. So they'll be sucked up onto the hydroxyl ions. And you'll go, say, to pH 11, only 10 to the minus 11th molar hydrogen ions. Under those conditions, we've shifted the equilibrium so that this extra proton on the amino group, that 3 should be a subscript, on the amino group can no longer be held under the demands of these hydroxyl ions. And so most of the molecules at pH 11 will in fact be uncharged at the amino group, and you'll have a net charge. You're certainly not going to have a hydrogen ion with this dearth of hydrogen ions at pH 11. You're certainly not going to have a hydrogen ion attached to the carboxyl. So that stays minus one. And then the net charge of the molecule great majority of the molecules at pH 11 will be minus 1, because the plus is no longer there. And in a symmetrical way, we can consider the addition of acid, hydrogen ions, say from hydrochloric acid, and those will shift the equilibrium by protonating this carboxyl. There's so many hydrogen ions present, you know, a million times more than at pH 7, right? Because each pH unit is a decade of concentration. It's a logarithmic function. So there's a million times more hydrogen ions, and that's just going to overcome this carboxyl, and it'll find itself protonated most of the time. And you'll have the net charge, and of course the amino group will be certainly protonated with all these hydrogen ions present. And so you have a net charge of plus 1. Now these are extremes, and often in this course for many years we left it at that, keep it simple, and don't talk about anything sort of gray area in between, but it's actually useful. And so this year and last year I've started to talk about it. And it's really fairly straightforward. If we want to say, if we want to consider not these extreme pHs, let's consider a pH that in which it's not so way over on one side or way over on the other side, but let's say 50-50. It's a nice even number. If it's 50-50, we can drop the pH. Let's see where I have it. Wrong keyboard. We can raise this pH, not to 11, but just to 8, and then it's still mostly charged on the amino group, and then to 9, and around 9, it's already about 50-50. So if this were, say, a stronger base, we would have to go to even higher pHs in order to pull that hydrogen ion off, higher hydroxyl ion concentrations to pull that hydrogen ion off. If we're a really good base, we might have to go to 10 or 11. But it's not such a strong base, so at 9, it's 50-50. If it were a weaker base, maybe at 8, it would have already started to lose its hydrogen ion. So it depends on the configuration in here, the electronegativity, the rest of the molecule, as to how strong a base or an acid is. And we can use this 50-50 point as a very convenient way of comparing different acids. The amino group on the amino acids, most of them are around 9. The different amino acids that our group will have some influence on it. So it might be, you know, 8.8 or 9.2 or 9.5 even for different amino acids. But it's around 9. And that value where you have an equal representation of the charged and uncharged state of the group is called the pK. And you can write that pK down in a book for any particular acid, like acetic acid, which is a weak acid. We eat it in vinegar. The pK, I forget, it's about 5, I think. That's an acid. All right, that's not as good as this. Let's go to the acid. The acid is the same case. We can add acid. Instead of going all the way to pH 1, we find that about pH 3 or 2.5, the carboxyl groups of most amino acids are protonated already. And if you go to 1, it's way over protonated. So a really strong acid, you might have to go to pH 1 before it starts to get protonated. And a really weak acid, maybe pH 5, right? Like citric acid, pH 5, or lemonade, you can drink it, right? So the pK, and so we'll use the pK now and again, not very much, as an indication of the strength of an acid, or base. All right, if we're going to talk about these monomers, and we need, just as we had in the sugars, we need to talk about the different carbons. So now we have to change that R to something specific. I pick lysine. Lysine's the English name for this amino acid. It doesn't tell you anything about the structure. It's just the historical name. So you can see here's the basic part of the sort of fundamental part of the amino acid. And then this is the side chain. So it's got a bunch of CH2s and then an amino group at the end. So I don't want to call this the basic part. This is actually the basic part. So that's going to be charged at, that's what it means, it's going to be charged at pH 7, right? Even though I'm not writing it that way. So if I want to talk about the amino group of this lysine, I could talk about either this one, which is right near the central carbon here. I can talk about this one, that's at the end. So we use the numbering system for that. The central carbon is given the letter, not a number, of alpha in the Greek alphabet, and then we just go up from that. Should be able to use this. Along the R group. Since this is the alpha carbon, anything that's attached to it can be given that alpha name. So this amino group would be the alpha amino group. It's the amino group that's attached to the alpha carbon. This carboxyl group is the alpha carboxyl. That's the alpha hydrogen. And as we go up, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. So the other amino group on the side chain, that's the epsilon amino group. So we can talk about it and communicate. In fact, I can never remember how many CH2s are in the side chain of lysine, but somehow I remember epsilon amino group. So I can just say, oh, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon is 4, right? Right. Okay, so now let's talk about some of the amino acids. Not all of them, although I urge you to take your text where they're organized in various ways. One text might organize them one way and the other text another way. Both, basically, they put them into polar or nonpolar, charged or non-charged. And they have different ways of representing them. This is not the way you have in your handout. But what it shares with your handout is that it's not shown in the ionized state. So we do that on purpose. Not so much because I know you know about the carboxyl and the amino now here, but about the side groups, you have to infer whether they're charged or polar or nonpolar. I want you to learn that from your memorization of the functional groups. So we don't give you any clue as to which are charged and which are not on the handout. You'll never have, I'm going through these structures, but you shouldn't memorize these structures. It's probably, it won't be absolutely necessary in this course to memorize the, not the names, but the abbreviations. So that HIS for histidines, that's easy. And in fact, the three-letter abbreviations are pretty easy. Glutamine is glun, cis for cysteine. But we also have one-letter abbreviations, which we'll see in a minute. And that's probably good to put to memory. Even the one-letter abbreviations, which are harder, is good to put to memory, especially if you're going to go on to other courses, 3,000-level courses in biology, where they might even assume that you have done that in this course. I know one of my colleagues complained that we didn't make you memorize it here. The one-letter amino acid code. So here they're like typed out here in Courier, and here the COOH and NH2 are the ones on the side, ones hanging down. You have to sort of look at the molecule to see where the R group is. But you should be able to do that. Here's glycine. The R group is just hydrogen. And there's another one down here. But let's use your handout just to make the point that you'll see them in different ways, and you should be facile at looking at the amino acid and seeing what's what. Okay, so here's your 20 amino acids, and with the three-letter abbreviation and the one-letter abbreviation, G for glycine, A for alanine, but then you go to aspartic acid, we already used the A, so we have to use something else, D, which makes not a lot of sense, but actually the first letter is available. No, B is available. Anyway, I don't know why it's D. You should put a red box around these. Nope. Battery must be getting low. Okay, so we'll talk about glycine because it's special. R group is just H, smallest amino acid, molecular weight about 75, is 75. A little bit boring. What else have I chosen here? Proline. Well, proline is kind of interesting. It's very unusual. So proline, if you remember the abbreviation, abbreviated organic chemical abbreviation, there's a CH2 here and a CH2 here and a CH2 here. And it kind of is connected back to itself. I'll have to keep going over here. So I don't know if this is much better, but since we're going to talk about it, I'll have to get down here. I put in the CH2 groups in the front half of the class. You can probably see that. So look at the central carbon here. It goes CH2, CH2, CH2. So that's basically a line of three CH2s, kind of hydrophobic side chain. But then it makes a bond right back to the nitrogen of the amino group, of the alpha amino group of the amino acid. Now this nitrogen has two bonds to carbon, not just one. All the amines we've seen so far just had one. It's still an amine. It's called a secondary amine because it has two bonds. Could have three bonds to carbon. It'd be a tertiary amine, and it's still a base. It'll still take up that hydrogen ion from water. So we have a plus exceptionally now in this box. I put the plus here to make the point that even though there are these two bonds here, it's still plus. There's to be H2 in the free proline. Then we could look at methionine. Methionine I put in a box because it's the first time we've met the element sulfur, which was in our minimal medium for E. coli. It's got to make methionine, E. coli does, and it's to use that sulfate and eventually put a sulfur atom in here. There's two amino acids that have sulfur. We'll meet them as we need to. Serine, just to show you a side chain that's polar, because I missed leucine up here. Leucine, CH2, CH, CH3, CH3, completely hydrocarbon, very hydrophobic side chain, as opposed to serine, which is essentially like a little methanol here. It's polar, a polar side chain. Right? Now, we can get even more polar with an actual acidic group. Lysine had the basic amino group on its side chain. Here's a little short side chain, but it has carboxyl group at the end. That'll be charged at pH 7, asp or D, aspartic acid. The ion would be called aspartate. Right? It's like sodium aspartate, if it were the salt of aspartic acid. If you put aspartic acid into solution, most of it is in the form of aspartate, the ion. Chemists might say the aspartate is a base because it could take up hydrogen ion, but we don't make these distinctions. Biochemists call aspartate as synonymous with aspartic acid, and it's easier to say. So we say that's aspartate. There's a longer one, glutamic acid, with an extra carbon, CH2 in here, glutamate. So glutamate, glutamic acid, acetic acid, acetate, biochemists use those synonymously, because we're always thinking pH 7, so we know what the state of it is. Even if I say aspartate or aspartic acid, I know what the situation is with respect to it. So we will use those synonymously, those kinds of terms. I bring it up here. I know I'm not out of them. Here's aspartate, here's asparagine, very related. And if you look at the structure, you see it is quite related, CH2, acetyl bond O, but instead of an OH making this a carboxyl, there's an NH2 which makes it an amide. It's very different. Amide is not charged, highly polar, all kinds of delta pluses and delta minuses, but not charged. Asparagine has an amide side group. Glutamate and glutamine also have that relationship. Here's an interesting one, arginine. And a nice long side chain and ends in this very complicated looking thing with three nitrogens, sort of amines, three amines all connected to a carbon. And indeed, that's very basic, even a stronger base with a higher pK than lysine does arginine. This group is called the guanido group. It's the only time we'll meet it. And whenever we have arginine, we have this guanido group. That's all you have to know. It's got a positive charge on it. I don't care exactly where that positive charge is. It's actually distributed amongst all three nitrogens and a very strong base. So there's two basic amino acids, lysine and arginine. There's two acidic ones, glutamate and aspartate. Here's another interesting side group, histidine. It's got a little ring here with two nitrogens in the ring. So there's that tertiary amine I was talking about and a secondary amine, and those are both somewhat basic, but in this ring structure they're actually pretty weak bases. And I can tell you how weak they are. They're so weak that in fact their pK is about 7. That is, at pH 7 they're only half charged, unlike the lysine primary NH2, or the amino acids NH2, which is NH3, almost all of it at pH 7. Histidine's side group is only about 50% charged. That turns out to be very useful for the function of some of these proteins, to be able to easily let go of a proton or take it up, sort of. Equally facile at either one. And you'll see that if you take biochemistry. We won't get into it probably here. Two more worth mentioning. Tyrosine. So here's a six-membered ring. It's a benzene ring with some double bonds. That's highly hydrophobic. It's got a CH2 here also. Seven hydrocarbon carbons, highly hydrophobic. They're only spoiled by this OH down here. Turns out this OH is actually almost acidic. Those deltas get very negative on this oxygen. So some books will call tyrosine polar because of this, and some books will say it's really nonpolar because of all these CH2s and CHs. I go with the second. I consider it more nonpolar. One thing that influences me is in the laboratory when I make up a solution of tyrosine, which I haven't done in a long time, but I used to, very hard to get in solution. So it's not very soluble in water. And so you see, the amino acids don't fall, or the organic chemicals in general don't fall into our pigeonholes of our rubrics, polar, nonpolar. Some are on the edge. Right? The same with tryptophan, which has a basic group in there, but otherwise is very extensive ring structure, two fused rings, reminiscent of the steroids with the four rings. And this is even harder to get in solution, so I would call this definitely, and most books do, nonpolar or hydrophobic side chain. These properties of the side chains are all important in the function of proteins. Okay, so that's a little survey of some of the side groups and the charges. Now let's talk about the three-dimensional structures we always do. Yes?
I have a question. A lot of times we see amino acids on some ingredients, there's an electron of it. Is there any biological significance to that?
Hold that question. The let's take the alpha carbon, which you'll excuse me for using two different colors. The central is the alpha carbon in here. And on the alpha carbon of each amino acid, we can see there's four groups. Well, we can see this must be glycine because the ball color is indicative of the same thing. So in any case, let's call this glycine. It is glycine. Hydrogen, amino, carboxyl. Brown carboxyl and a green amino. And here is another glycine molecule, the same four groups attached to it. Are these actually identical molecules? The acid test is if they're superimposable and you can't tell the difference. So if I put the brown here and the whites here, yes, these are superimposable, right? So they're both glycine and they're both identical glycine. But suppose I would change these to relative positions of this carboxyl, which was the carboxyl now? The brown is the carboxyl, I think. Doesn't matter. Green is the amino. Now can I superimpose them? How many say, yes, I can? How many say, no, I cannot? The no's have it about 3-1. Morning class was much better. Let's see. No, this doesn't work. Yeah, you can superimpose them. Majority of you were wrong. Majority of you were expecting me to be demonstrating stereoisomers. Just expecting it, right? So you just knee-jerked, right? You don't want to knee-jerk in this. The worst thing you can do is knee-jerk in this class. You have to think about it, right? Well, maybe that was kind of hard to think about until I make this point. If we would not have glycine but make it alanine, let's take these hydrogens off and put on a methyl group. Now there's no rhyme or reason to where I took it off, so let's see what happens. Now they are still superimposable. So this is alanine now because it's got this orange methyl group, carboxyl and amino group, and a hydrogen white. And now I will switch it. And now I will again switch, well, it doesn't matter, any two groups. Let me take the carboxyl in the amino group from whatever it was to this new situation. I won't ask for a show of hands here. Obviously, one of these is not going to be superimposable. And it's this one. If I put the orange, then the brown and green don't. And this two are okay, but these are not. And if I make these okay, then these are not. So these, there's no way I can superimpose these. It's like your left hand, your right hand. They both look the same, but you can't superimpose them. Another way to look at it is that these are mirror images of each other, right? The green, green, brown, the orange over here. These are three different structures in three-dimensional space. Chemically, they're virtually identical. I mean, how could they be different? There's a central carbon, and in equal directions on all sides, it's got these four groups, which are the same in both of them. So this is alanine, and this is also alanine, but we have to distinguish them apart. So we have to give them a name, like alpha and beta, or one and two. And what was done early on when this was realized, they're actually able to purify one away from the other, which is not easy, since they're so similar. But if you had a pure solution, and you could buy this from Sigma Chemical Company, a pure solution of this form, and shine polarized light through a tube containing it, the molecules will reflect the light and bend it. And they will bend it to the left. So the Latin for left is levo, and this is called, we'll call this the L one, because the other one is the mirror image of this, and it refracts it to the right, which in Latin is dextro. So this is the D form. So here's your L form and your D form. So does that mean we have like 40 different amino acids that we have to deal with, 20 L's and 20 D's? No, well, first of all, of course not 40, because I showed you right before that glycine doesn't do this because it's got two. The only ones that will do this is they have to have a carbon with four different groups attached, which is called an asymmetric carbon. The asymmetric carbon means that you can't pass a plane through this molecule in any position, a plane in which you'll have the same thing on both sides. You can do that with glycine. If you put a plane, if this were white here, right, and I put a plane through like this, and white here and white there, half a brown here, half a brown there, the two would be mirror images of each other. But if it has four different groups, you can't do that. That carbon, which has four different groups attached, occurs frequently in nature, and it's called in organic chemistry, and it's called asymmetric. So whenever you have an asymmetric carbon, you have the possibility of making two three-dimensional structures in space, which will bend light in different ways, so they're called sometimes optical isomers. But more generally, a better word is, I think, stereoisomers. They're different only in three dimensions and not in their chemical connectivity at all.
Right.
So we could have. So there are, in fact, 39 different amino acids you can buy from Sigma Chemical Company, glycine, and the other 38 L and D of the other 19 amino acids. But in nature and in proteins, thankfully, you find only the L. Only the L is the natural one in proteins. They eschew the D when they make proteins. When we make proteins, or E. coli makes proteins, or anybody that's ever made a protein in the last billion years has always used the L form. Started with L and just stuck with it. You will find D in a few odd places, like certain bacterial cell walls stuck in, attached to some sugar, but we don't have to think about those or consider them. Okay, so this next graphic, which is number 9, summarizes what I said and uses a pretty nice picture from Sadhava text, which shows that mirror image business. And the difference can be very important. And very, I mean, what's the difference? We use L or D. I mean, they're chemically the same. But biology is about recognition of the molecules, and as we'll see. But I'll give you a little preview here. So I pick up this molecule. Let's say I'm a machine in the cell that has to deal with alanine, has to deal with that methyl group. It's going to take a bite out of that methyl group. And the way it recognizes alanine is it grabs a carboxyl on the left, an amino on the right. And then it's expect to find, then, right near its jaws, the methyl group. If I took the L, I took the carboxyl and the amino on left and right, I just got the hydrogen. So I don't do anything with it. But this L guy, I can work with. So that's why evolution has used the simplicity of just using all the L's and not getting, because D is very different than for that recognition problem. You need a completely different machine to be able to recognize D compared to L. Let's go back to sugars for a minute. We can understand maybe a little more about these different sugars. Do sugars also have asymmetric carbons? They sure do. Let's look at our glucose, which I sometimes call mysteriously D-glucose. Now we know what the D means. This glucose will refract polarized light to the right. Does it have any, here's our amino acids in a form you could even draw yourself on your notebook paper, showing what comes out of the screen and what goes behind the screen. Let's say number one. Is number one symmetric or not? Well, because that C double bond O, yes, you can make a plane through this molecule. It'll be the same on both sides around this carbon and cut right through the middle of this R group. How about two? Two, you have four different groups. The CHO is connected to it, the OH, the H, and all the rest hanging down here as another, say, R group. Four different groups on carbon two, so carbon two is in fact asymmetric, and so you can write two different forms of glucose. And in fact, if you look at number three, it's got this CHO is one group. All the rest below it is another group, and an H and an OH are different. C3 is also asymmetric, as is C4, as is C5. Does that mean if I have two forms, let's not worry about what they're called yet, but if you have the two different stereoisomers with respect to two, then you pick one of those and then you go to three and you can make two different ones for three, given that one for two. That means there's like four different ones you can now write. And 16. You can write 16 combinations then of this C6H12OH with all OHs and Hs all connected to central carbons in the same way, but in different ways in space. So there should be 16 stereoisomers of glucose, and there are 16 ways. Not all of them are found in nature, but a lot of them are. Here's, for example, a molecule that's different at every single position. If this OH is on the right, this one's on the left. And if you think hard about the Fischer projection when you go home, not now, you can see that this is telling you the structure. So this structure is just opposite at every case. It's the extreme, and that's called L-glucose, very appropriately. This one's all D, and this one's all L. But the other ones have to have special names. You can call it like D1, D2, L3, D4, D5. Instead, they just use English names. So at C2, if the OH is switched to the other position, it's called mannose. And at C4, it's called galactose. So all these names of these other sugars, they're just like glucose, different in space. But the difference is important. How could one little OH in space make a difference? Well, you missed the point of the last week's lectures. They can make a big difference in the structures, especially if they go into polymers. But even to be recognized, just as our alanine, L-alanine had to be recognized. Mannose we can use for energy. We convert it to glucose. Mannose is also displayed very often and abundantly on the surface of our cells, outside of our cells, cell membranes, as is galactose. All right, so let's put these monomers together in a polymer. The polymer here will be called a polypeptide because the bond that's formed as we condense two amino acids here on graphic 11 and take out this HOH by dehydration again. So I've used these same two words, condensation and dehydration. That bond that forms, which I'll show you on the next graphic 12 here, the HOH is gone, and you have what's left of the carboxyl is a C double bond O, that's all. What's left of the amino is the NH. Most of it is there, lost an H. And the new bond here results in a C double bond O, NH. We've met that before. That's the amide group. So we have formed an amide bond. If the amide bond is an amide bond connecting two amino acids, it's called especially a peptide bond. So it's just nomenclature. All peptide bonds are indeed amide bonds, but not all amides need to be peptide bonds. You could have amides connecting other things than amino acids, other amides. Right? So this is called the peptide bond, and once you put two together, we have a peptide. A little one, a dipeptide. Right? It's like a disaccharide. Tripeptide, oligopeptide, polypeptide. So polypeptide would be a long chain of amino acids strung together. Let's talk about this molecule. This is a little tripeptide. We can introduce nomenclature so we can talk about it. We already introduced the peptide bond. We can also introduce the word residue. Residue, it's what's left, appropriately, of the amino acid as you look for it in the interior of this polypeptide. So you have the NH, not NH2. You have the side group. You have the hydrogen, the central alpha carbon here. You have the C double bond O, and that's all that's left. You're missing an H from the left side and an OH from the right, the water that was used to make the bond. So the residue has most of the amino acid right in there. Nevertheless, it's not a free amino acid. It doesn't have a charge on its left side and another charge on its right side anymore. That charge has been lost. It's polar here. These are going to be polar, but they're not charged. The only ones that are charged are the ones that are left on the left end. By convention, we draw the amino acids with the amino on the left. You can make exceptions to that if you want to make a point, but if you're not making any special point, amino's on the left, the same for peptides. Amino on the left, you end up with a carboxyl on the right. Those will be charged. This one is shown, this one is not shown, but you know it. So the residue is a repeating unit. And the ends are called the amino end and the carboxyl end, or they're called the amino end and the carboxy end, or they're called the N-terminus and the C-terminus, or the N-terminal and the C-terminal. They all mean the same thing. Here's what you have in your handout. It's a pentapeptide. And again, we have the amide bond, the residues. Here's three of the residues, three internal residues we have now. And we introduce just one additional term, which is the backbone. So the backbone are all the atoms except the side groups. So the backbone is useful to look at when you look at a protein and you don't want this busyness of all the side groups. Side groups are all important, but nevertheless, it's sometimes useful to talk about the backbone, and that's what it means. I've been saying polypeptides, and yet the subject is protein. So what's the difference? This sometimes is a little ambiguous. It's not, by definition, it's not. But in usage, it's not. The terms are not always used correctly, even by me, maybe especially by me. A polypeptide of the amino acids connected in a linear way, that's the polymer. That's a polypeptide. Nobody argues about that. So what's a protein? A protein could be a polypeptide. Polypeptide, that could be a synonymous. You have a protein that's made up of a long polypeptide chain, and that's it. That's also the protein. But some proteins have more than one different polypeptide chains associated with each other. Or they could be the same. We'll get into that next time. So the protein is a word that's a little more flexible. It could take more than one polypeptide chain when we talk about the protein. But sometimes I'll say protein when I meet polypeptide and vice versa. So you have to take it from context. A peptide, as opposed to a polypeptide, could be as small as just two amino acids, a dipeptide. Here's the side chain just shown without the R groups, and you can see how monotonous it is. It's sort of like cellulose. It's the same thing over and over again. But of course, the polypeptide doesn't really look like this. It's got all these 20 different amino acid side chains hanging down. But without the R groups, the backbone itself is very monotonous. Now, proteins, I keep emphasizing, do most of the jobs in the cell. Let's take a little short survey just to show the different kinds of jobs they may do, just from some of the proteins that you may be familiar with. The white of an egg is egg albumin. There's a protein that's used as a nutrient for the growing chick, source of amino acids, if you will. So that's a little bit boring. Hemoglobin, which is in our red blood cells, is a protein that's used as a carrier of a small molecule. That small molecule is oxygen. So it takes up oxygen, very important carrier. Not boring at all, actually. very sophisticated the way it binds oxygen in our lungs and then lets go of it in our tissues. So that's a carrier protein. Keratin is in this tough layer of skin that covers mammals and also in our hair and fingernails. So it's a structural protein, sort of like the structure of that E. coli cell wall, protecting us from the environment. So there's a protein that serves a structural role. Estrogen receptor is kind of a sensing protein. So receptor means it'll respond to estrogen. It's a protein that will respond to estrogen. When estrogen is present, it will bind to this estrogen receptor, which is just floating around in the cytoplasm of the cell. It's not one of those receptors that's on the cell membrane. There's plenty of those, but I choose one that's inside the cell. Maybe because I said steroids can get right into the cell because they're hydrophobic. They go right through that phospholipid bilayer, and they do, and then they can meet their partner inside the cell, the estrogen receptor or testosterone receptor. And then once it binds, it goes and does something interesting, which you won't learn about in this course, but maybe next semester. All right, then finish here. Immunoglobulins. So they're in our bloodstream. There are antibodies. That's synonymous. Antibodies are made of immunoglobulin proteins. There are different types. And their job, again, is to bind something very specifically, in this case, a pathogen or some poison, toxin, and so protect us from the ill effects of those things. And finally, we have the proteins that are enzymes. I'm going to spend a lot of time on these enzymes because they do rather amazing things inside the cell. And they are the catalysts that catalyze all those transformations that are necessary for E. coli to grow in minimal medium and transform glucose into tryptophan with many steps, all those arrows in that big round flow of glucose. All those are enzymes and more. Enzymes that build the membrane, that build the cell wall, that replicate our DNA. Enzymes do it all. Beta-galactosidase, a famous enzyme, because we know a lot about it, and we know a lot about its gene. It has medical interest because many people, as they get older, don't make enough of this. And I mentioned this enzyme before, I think, that breaks down lactose. So beta-galactosidase. The enzymes are sometimes, very often, named in a way you can kind of figure out what they do. The ACE means hydrolysis, usually. It's add water. Galactoside means galactose attached to something else, like lactose, where it's attached to glucose. So it could be attached to something else, and this beta-galactosidase would still cleave it. It'll hydrolyze the galactose sugar off of a disaccharide or longer. At least disaccharide. And it has to be in the beta conformation for it to work. So that's the beta-galactosidase from beta-galactose. So that's an enzyme that, and if you don't have that, then you're sensitive to dairy products for some reason. Now, each particular polypeptide is defined by the sequence of amino acids that make it up. We talk about protein structure and polypeptide structure. We're going to be talking about, or protein structure, four levels of organization in this structure. The most fundamental level, and it's going to be like primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. So primary is just the sequence of the amino acids, and that's what we'll talk about for a while, the sequence of amino acids. So each molecule of a particular protein has an English name. It'll have a particular sequence of amino acids. Each molecule will have that of that protein with that particular English name, like albumin, will have that sequence. And it might, you know, start out looking like this. Right? So at this point, we're going to ask, which we haven't asked before, is that how do we know this? We don't have time to do a lot of how do we know this. It's an interesting way to teach, but wouldn't finish our story if we did that. But we'll take some time to talk about methods. And this is one of those times. This is the first time. And we talk about methods for two reasons. One, and the primary reason, is not really to satisfy your curiosity about how do we know this, although that's a useful question to answer, but because if we talk about the manipulation of these molecules in the laboratory, you get to know the molecule If you're going to vary the pH to pH 1, we already started that a little bit. You're going to fool around at pH 1 and not just consider pH 7 all the time. How's the molecule going to behave? Well, now you know, so how do those charges behave? So, in general, as we manipulate the molecules in the laboratory and subject them to various clever strategies towards the end of finding out about them, you will become more intimate with these molecules. And that's the reason, main reason we go to methodology. And the other reason is because the methodology is interesting in its own right, to see how particular small problems, or sometimes big problems, were solved, but just a sample of them, right? So let's talk about methodology and the question of how do we know the primary sequence of a protein? So, and I'll give you just one way to do this. And it's complicated. First thing you have to do, if you want to know the sequence, what's in the first position? By first, I mean the N-terminal, because with English speaking, we're going from left to right. So what's at the second position? What's at the third position? What's at the 499th position? So the way we do this today is much different than 40 years ago when I took my biochemistry course. It's done by a method called mass spectroscopy. And what you do is you take, well, first you have to purify the protein, because if you have a mixture of the 3,000 proteins of E. coli, let's say, and you're just going to get gibberish out as far as positions go. You're going to have everything at every position. And even if you have just two proteins, you won't know which position was filled with what amino acid. So it must be pure, or at least purified, 95% purified, so you can see the majority of what's going on. That's not an easy thing to do, and we'll talk about that methodology next week. So let's assume now we have a purified protein, let's say our egg albumin, which is easy because it's almost pure albumin in the egg white. So what will happen is if you could take this protein, you put it in this machine which bombards it with ions and fragments it, or you could fragment it first, and then these pieces, these small pieces of the protein are then ionized in a vacuum chamber and placed between a negative and positive pole, and they have this positive or negative charge, and they go towards the positive pole right through this vacuum, and the length of time it takes from the point of departure till they hit that, what did I say, positive pole is measured with great accuracy, and the time it takes is related in a very sensitive way to its molecular weight of that fragment. So if you had a fragment that was alanine, alanine, glycine, valine, tetrapeptide, say, then you would get the molecular weight of that to 2 decimal points. So if it were glycine, alanine, alanine, would have very different molecular weight. And so by getting these thousands of different fragments and seeing their exact molecular weight, one is able to sort of reconstruct, using computers, what the original sequence was, if it's broken up in different ways. All right. This is a little mysterious, but that's sort of the way it's done nowadays. I'm going to give you an old-fashioned way that's still hard, but it's easier to understand. So one way you can attack this problem is to use an enzyme on the protein. The enzyme itself is a protein, but we use the enzyme as a reagent, an enzyme called a protease. The protease, from the ACE, you know it's going to hydrolyze something, it's going to hydrolyze a protein. It could be called a peptidase, hydrolyze a peptide. So we have several kinds of, two kinds of peptidases, endopeptidases that would cut inside, we'll meet those in a minute, and exopeptidases that will cleave just from the outside, just from the terminus, either an amino peptidase or a carboxypeptidase. So there's an enzyme called carboxypeptidase. We make it. We use it to help break down the proteins we eat. In our stomachs, you'll find it. So carboxypeptidase has the property of always attacking the free alpha carboxyl group at the end of all peptides. And it hydrolyzes the first one. And then it will go on to hydrolyze the second one. So if you mix carboxypeptidase with your protein, with your polypeptide, and wait just a short time, a few seconds, let's say, and then separate whatever has been cleaved off here by the hydrolysis from this longer molecule. Maybe the long molecule has been affixed to a bead or some solid surface, and you just wash this away. Or that's the usual way it's done, in fact, right? So you can wash this away and collect it. What came off in the first few seconds? Let's say this was the molecule's end. It's serine. Serine came off in the first few seconds. And so we can separate it and put it in a tube. That's the tube that came off in the first few seconds. And the next tube is what came off in the next few seconds. So that's going to be aspartate. Maybe a little bit of the serine didn't make it into the first tube, so you're contaminated with a slight amount of serine. So mostly aspartate. Maybe the enzyme actually jumped ahead and got the aspartate and started cleaving the glutamate here, so there's a little bit of glutamate. But basically you see this is almost all serine, this is almost all aspartate, and you keep going down. But this contamination just keeps like building up. So after you're going about 10 or 20 amino acids in, the synchrony is lost. So this method is limited to about 20, if you're lucky. 20 amino acids from the carboxyl end can be sequenced this way. Nevertheless, it's useful information. Now, if I say, well, it's serine, and this one is aspartate, how do we know that? So all we have is a tube with some amino acid in it. How do we know what amino acid it is? Well, we can examine, we can tell what it is by looking at its behavior and separate one amino acid from the other and how it behaves in a separation. That's a very common way of identifying things. And so let's consider two different ways of identifying amino acids. The first is easy. It's paper electrophoresis. So you can take a sheet of paper, wet it with some salt solution, keep it wet by putting its ends, and this is a side, sort of front view, so the paper's going back behind the screen. This is a trough of salt solution, and so the ends of this paper are wicking the solution up in here. Everything is staying wet, and so there's good electric conductivity through the salt solution all the way from one trough to the other, in which case you put wires that come from a source of electric potential, like a battery. Except you can't use a battery, you have to use a special power supply, because in order to move these amino acids, it takes like 2,000 volts or 3,000 volts. This is a dangerous procedure. Laboratories are dangerous places. So if we look at that from the top, and let's say we put a mixture of alanine, glutamate, and lysine. See, I'm saying the words, but visually, if you had memorized these, it would also be more apparent to you. At pH 7, say, but we could use a different pH. At pH 7, the alanine will be uncharged because it has a methyl group for its side chain, which you can tell by looking at your handout. I tell you it. Lysine, maybe you remember, the first one we looked at had the amino group. Glutamate or glutamic acid has the carboxyl, so it has a negative, net negative charge of minus 1 at pH 7. It's going to go towards the positive pole, which we call the anode in biology. And the cathode is a negative pole. The lysine will go there. So that's pretty clear. Right. So the charged amino acids, the four charged amino acids, can be separated this way. They have those net charges. And it's useful, but not as useful as the second technique, which is much more subtle. Oh, here's a picture of this dangerous machine. The second method is called paper chromatography, a very old method, and it's more versatile. Paper chromatography takes advantage of the hydrophobic or polar nature of the side chain of the amino acid. We'll separate on the basis of how polar or how hydrophobic. These are two sides of the same coin. And this is how it works. You take, again, paper. In this case, the paper is all important because it's made of cellulose, and that's going to play a big role. This cellulose blotting paper is stuck, let's say, in a trough, and we stick in this trough, and it's dry. We put our amino acids or amino acid mixtures along some straight pencil line over here and dry them down. So we put this dry paper now and wet the end of it and hold it up somehow. And what's going to happen is this solution is going to, this liquid is going by capillary action, make its way through the fibers of the paper. It's going to go, go, go. It might start to evaporate. So you put the whole thing into a jar and seal it up so we don't have to worry about it evaporating. And it'll go, go, go all the way to the top. We stop it before it goes to the top. So we know how far the liquid has gone. Now, what liquid is this? It's important that it be a mixture of water and something that's more that's less polar than water, like isopropanol, rubbing alcohol. It's got three carbons on it in addition to the OH. So we have these two solutions in a way, two solvents. Right? Now, if we take a, this should be up here at the front, let's say. Here's the front coming up here. This is dry still. As these liquids go by the amino acids, or it could be where the amino acid is, the pink is going to be the water molecules. The water molecules are going to be held by the paper through hydrogen bonding to all those hydroxyl ions of the sugar groups of cellulose. So they're going to be not so mobile. It's called the stationary phase of this, of these, between these two solvents. One is stationary and one is more mobile, the mobile phase. They're both moving, but one is more mobile than the other. And the one that's least mobile is called stationary. The isopropanol, this purple or purplish color, no, bluish color, is going with less affinity for the cellulose, so it's going faster. The amino acid now is dissolved in this stuff as the liquid passes, and each molecule then has to make a decision and will be in equilibrium between these two phases. The more hydrophobic it is, the more time it's going to spend in the more apolar solvent, the isopropanol. The more hydrophilic it is, the more polar itself is, the more time it'll spend in water. The more time it spends in water, the more it's impeded from getting to the end. It's going to lose the race if this is a race. And so the more hydrophobic molecules, whether amino acids or any other organic molecule, will move with the mobile phase, and the more polar ones will move more slowly. And so this will keep taking place over and over again as the solution moves up. And the net result would be, let's say, that if we had a bunch of amino acids, we'd see that aspartate, being charged, most polar, is hardly moved. So locked into this immobile water, the serine has been able to break away a little, glycine sort of in between neutral, tryptophan is more hydrophobic, isoleucine most hydrophobic. You can almost measure the hydrophobicity this way. So you can quantify this by saying, and reproduce it. Say you measure, but you don't let this front go off the edge, but you stop the chromatography. You stop the process, take out the paper, dry it down, you spray the paper with a reagent that reacts with the, I think the amino groups of the alpha amino groups, it turns purple, so you know where the spots are, and so you can measure how far your spot, your isoleucine had gone. Let's say isoleucine you bought from Sigma Chemical Company, let's say it ran over here as a standard, it ran 82% as far as the front did. Relative to the front, 0.82 if the front was 1. RF, relative to the front. So all the amino acids or any compound will have an RF value for a given set, for a given mixture, particular mixture, like 70% isopropanol, which is like rubbing alcohol, it's often used, and temperature. And it's written down in a book, so you say, okay, if this went to 0.82, it must be isoleucine, because that's what it gives. Whereas 0.69 is indicative of tryptophan. In reality, you don't trust these numbers, and you just buy all 20 amino acids from Sigma Chemical Company, run them out in 20 lanes, and just match your amino acid with how far your standard went. And bingo, you have it. You can't do all 20 this way with one solvent system, but if you change the solvent system to something else, then you get different behaviors, and with two different chromatographies, you can identify all 20 amino acids. So it's very powerful and easy. There's an apparatus for the paper chromatography. It's the simplest possible apparatus. Not very good because the seal isn't very good. Usually we have a nice jar with grease on the top and a plate to make sure it's a good seal. But you can do it this way, as this was done, separating magic marker ink into its various components, which I used to do in class, but ate up too much time. Okay. However, we have an amino acid that's, we have a polypeptide that's 100 or 500 long. We can only get 20 out of this carboxypeptidase. So we have to chop up first our polypeptide into smaller bite-sized pieces, then sequence each of these pieces. So we can do that, and we can separate them, say, on the basis of their size, and then we can get the sequence of each subpeptide. How can we break it up? We can break it up in a very specific way by using another enzyme, one of these endopeptidases, like trypsin, again, in our stomach when we eat a steak. So this enzyme has the specificity that it just doesn't cleave anywhere inside, but specifically after a positively charged side group, which is lysine or arginine. So it will cleave after. After means, as we go from left to right, after the carboxyl group of the, that's where it's going to add the water, after the carboxyl group of lysine, of the lysine residue inside the protein. So you have a lysine here, a lysine here, an arginine here, a lysine here, and you get these five subpeptides. This is a little simplified, but but you get tryptic peptides, they're called, in fact. Make an adjective out of trypsin. Okay, so now you've got the sequence of all of these, because maybe they're all less than 20. But you don't know the order. Here you can see the order, but you know, you just have the tube. You don't see this diagram. You just have this subpeptide has this sequence, this subpeptide, and you don't know how they were put together. So you have to add one more step. You do the experiment again, except this time use a different enzyme, chymotrypsin. Similar name, but very different specificity. This one cleaves after side groups that have rings, aromatic rings in them, which are tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine. In any case, they cleave after those three, but not histidine. They cleave after those three, and so if you take another sample of your protein and cleave it with this red chymotrypsin, you get these different subpeptides. Here you got this big long one, here you got a short one. They obviously have the same information, the same sequence, it's just been broken up in different places. So now with arms, this is difficult, right? I mean, in the laboratory it's very difficult to get the sequence of a protein. So what you can see is that you have one tryptic peptide that had a lot of similarity and overlap with the sequence of this chymotryptic peptide. Then they're not cleaved the same place because they have different specificities, but these two line up. So now you know the sequence goes all the way from here to the common part and then to here. So we can start building the sequence together and just keep looking at these overlaps, and we can sort of reconstruct things. Now we're almost there. We have this bunch. We don't know if this is on the left or on the right and vice versa for this one, but we have one more to do. And we get that one, which just gives us enough few amino acids here so we know it belongs here, and the rest of it must match up with, it's got to be with this one, right? So, indeed, we have now the sequence of the protein. So that's hard, but we have it. And it's easier nowadays. Not much of this is done so much nowadays, because we can go to the DNA that codes for this, and that's a lot easier. But we're not done with our methods. Now that you know about chromatography and electrophoresis, and you know how hard it is to sequence these proteins, you can put yourself back to the 1960s when people didn't know too many sequences, and it was hard, and they were doing it this way. And a guy named Vernon Ingram was very interested in the molecular basis of genetic disease. And the disease he was particularly interested in was sickle cell disease. Sickle cell disease, let's see, am I ready for this? That's just the same thing. Sickle cell disease, people who have inherited this disease, it's a genetic disease, you inherit it, have red blood cells that are, many of which are in the form of sickles, not all of them. Red blood cells normally look like frisbees. And make their way through tiny capillaries, even where only one can fit through. When you have these pointy, misshapen red blood cells, they can jam up the capillaries from time to time, and then you have a crisis and very painful and very serious disease. So he was interested in why some people had it and most people don't. And he thought maybe it had something to do with the major proteins that are in the red blood cells. Red blood cells are about 70-80% hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is made up of, one of those proteins made up of two polypeptide chains, an alpha and beta polypeptide. So he ended up looking at the beta globin, it's called beta globin, and he didn't want to have to sequence it all the time. So he thought, well, a quick way to tell the difference between, see if there's any difference in the sequence of this protein in sickle cell patients versus normal patients would be something called fingerprinting or two-dimensional separation. First thing he did is take trypsin and break it into fragments like this. Then, no further digestion to amino acids here. He's just making these subpeptides. Subpeptides, my own word, you won't see it elsewhere, they just call them peptides. But I put the sub to impress you that it's coming from the polypeptide. Now, let's consider one of these subpeptides, and what is behavior going to be like? We saw the behavior of the amino acids. What's the behavior of a little peptide? Right. Here's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, a hexapeptide that has this sequence. I know where I got this sequence. Alanine, tyrosine, glutamate, proline, valine, tryptophan. What's going to be the behavior of this in paper electrophoresis? Well, it's very easy. pH 7, let's say. Let's keep it simple. pH 7 is going to have a positive charge here. It's going to have a negative charge at the carboxyl end, right? It's like graphic 28. And we look around here. That's not really charged. Ah, there's a negative charge there. Nothing else is charged. So this has two negatives and a positive. Has a net negative charge of minus 1. It's going to go towards the anode. So it could have been longer with 20, and it could have had 6 different charges, some positive, some negative, maybe a whole bunch positive. Could have plus 6. It would really go towards the cathode. So electrically, in paper electrophoresis, the peptide is just a composite of all the amino acid properties. And the same is true in paper chromatography. In paper chromatography, this has got a little bit of a hydrophobic guy over here in alanine. Tyrosine, okay, I think mostly hydrophobic, maybe a little compromised here. Glutamic acid, certainly not hydrophobic, very polar with this negative charge. Proline's hydrophobic, valine very hydrophobic, tryptophan very hydrophobic. So we got 5 out of 6 hydrophobic, it's going to be mostly hydrophobic, and so it will go pretty fast along towards with the front in paper chromatography as a peptide. So you can do paper chromatography and paper electrophoresis on peptides as well as amino acids as long as they're small enough. Just a nomenclature part so you're not confused. You can talk about this hexapeptide as the allotyr glue pro val trip, just using the 3-letter abbreviations, or the 1-letter abbreviations, AYEPVW. Sometimes you'll see it like this and it confuses a few people. You make a little fancier and make an adjective out of all the amino acids that precede the last one. This is alanyl, tyrosyl, glutamyl, prolyl, valyl, tryptophan. It's not important, but just don't be thrown off by it. That's all it means. They all mean the same thing. Okay, so what's this two-dimensional separation? Ingram put his mixture of subpeptides right out of the trypsin reaction on the middle of one side of a sheet of blotting paper, and subjected this paper to electrophoresis so that the positive the peptides with a net positive charge would go down here or to this direction, and the negative ones would go in the other direction. So after the electrophoresis and he stopped it, he has all these different positions, and in these positions, of course, two of the peptides might have had the same minus one, but completely different sequence. And they would maybe end up at the same place. It's just charge that's bringing them here. So they could be the same size and the same net charge. That'll happen quite often. So this is not a sufficient resolution. There's lots of subpeptides hiding under these spots. Some of them could be pure, single species, but many of them could have 2, 3, or 5 different species. So he needs a second method to separate them, and he'll use paper electrophoresis. Just turns this paper down 90 degrees. So he puts all the subpeptides now strung out by their electrophoretic behavior, sticks this in the trough of the chromatography apparatus, and runs the chromatography up in this direction. The most hydrophobic will run the fastest. The least hydrophobic, the most polar, will run the slowest. And you have this two-dimensional pattern of all the subpeptides. And once you've done this, almost all the time, all the peptides run to their own place. And each spot represents a unique subpeptide. So here's from normal. This is the case from normal beta globin. If he does the same experiment using beta globin derived from a sickle cell patient, he sees pretty much the same thing, except here, this spot, 1, 2, 3, is missing. It's not there. And a new spot has appeared here. He could just cut out that spot with a pair of scissors, elute it, and run the carboxypeptidase reaction on it. They're small enough, he can get the complete sequence. He finds that the peptide is exactly the same in both cases, except for one amino acid. So glutamate is present in the middle of this guy in the normal place. In place of glutamate, it's valine in the case of the sickle cell pupil. It takes another patient, same exact thing. This was the first determination, a molecular basis of a genetic disease in the 60s. And so Ingram, sometimes called the father of molecular medicine, and I actually had the pleasure of taking a course with him when I was a graduate student. He's no longer with us. Makes sense in terms of what we know about separation, that it has valine, which is more hydrophobic, so it went further up in the chromatography step, and because it has one less negative charge, it didn't go... starting in the middle, it didn't go as far towards on the left side here, which was the anode down here. So we turn this like this. So it didn't go as far because it had one less negative charge than the peptide that had the valine instead of the glutamate. So he didn't have to sequence, go through this whole business sequencing the whole thing. Just had to sequence one little peptide. And in general, these two-dimensional separations are handy because if you take not just genetically different or mutant proteins compared to normal, you take two different proteins. What do I have? Do I have the same protein here or is it different? You run one of these 2D separations, you see one protein gives this pattern, the next protein gives a completely different pattern. It has a different sequence of amino acids, different places where the lysines and the arginines are, different properties of the subpeptides between those lysines and arginines. And virtually every protein out of 100,000 different proteins that exist in just people, there's maybe 100,000 different proteins in us, then you'll get 100,000 different, I mean, it's a slight exaggeration, maybe one will be the same. We always say, how do you know it's exactly? But it's like fingerprints. You might find it hard to distinguish certain two people, but it's a very good indicator of uniqueness, fingerprints are, and that's why the name is given. So this is protein fingerprinting, nothing to do with our fingers. Next time, we will start on the three-dimensional structure of proteins.